The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.
Today FM.
Sorry for your trouble. What a great Irish phrase that is. And it's the title of Anne-Marie Horahan's new book, looking at the Irish way of death. Anne-Marie Horahan, thank you very much for joining us. That expression, I'm sure, has been used by so many of our listeners. I know I've used it so many times. Where does it come from and why do you think people use it?
Well, I think nobody's quite sure where it came from. And like a lot of traditions, when you look at it, I think it's not as old as we think. You know, it would be maybe 100 years old at an absolute max, I'm right in saying. But I can't talk about that authoritatively because nobody's sure where it came from or where it started. But it isn't one of those things that goes back to the dawn of time, not at all. But I mean, it is a great phrase and it covers everything. It's sympathetic. It doesn't talk about the circumstances of the death. It just takes care of business. And
it's almost unanswerable, isn't it?
It is. But that's the great thing about it. It doesn't need an answer. Actually, the answers to it are rather lame, like, thank you. You know, and it's also lovely when if you are bereaved and somebody says it to you, it has a very gentle, warm feeling about it.
Sort of an empathetic, understanding expression.
Very. And not prying, not looking for any info, not wallowing, not asking you to become, as the bereaved person or me, to become emotional, you know. So it's a gentle touch that kind of covers all the bases. It covers whatever you want it to cover. And that's why I chose it for the title for the book.
I've also been struck, though, that the sort of the idea of death has been trouble for those left behind.
Yeah. Well, also, I think I always take it, and when I use it, I always take it that it covers the trouble before the death, which is, I always looking at that way.
I think that's one of the key things in your book, isn't it? Because it's actually the circumstances leading up to death. Mm-hmm. And I'm very taken by the fact this book was a project you started before COVID.
Oh, long before, yeah. Four years ago, yeah.
And then ended up covering the period of COVID, because two things jump out for me in relation to during the COVID period. One, the circumstances of funerals, which you cover in the book, because the tradition was upended by COVID. Mm. But perhaps even more importantly, which you emphasise, what happened for people when they were unable to be with loved ones during the last weeks, days, hours? How distressing that may have been for many of the people who were dying, who were conscious of that, but also for their loved ones who didn't get the opportunity to be with people. I mean, that's one of the greatest cruelties imaginable, I think.
It is, because it's separation, you know. It's separation when you love somebody and they're in trouble. You want to be with them, even if you can't help them, even if you can't improve the situation. So it was an enforced separation.
But that actually can be as much for the person who continues to live, isn't it? As much for the person who's dying. Yes, you want to give comfort to the person who's dying, but you're almost taking a certain comfort yourself out of being with them.
Oh, no, 100%, because you feel you're doing something. But I think during COVID, and remember, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people around the country with a variety of relatives and a variety of reasons why they couldn't see them, but mainly because they were in medical institutions, either residential care or hospitals or nursing homes. And it happened to everybody and you feel really helpless. And that is the worst feeling that you can possibly have, I think, around death, that there's nothing you can do. You know, it's very, very distressing. And also, I think a lot of people who that affected were like my own father. You know, he wasn't a mobile phone type of guy. He wasn't a texting kind of guy. He wasn't a FaceTime kind of guy. So then you're really stuck. You know, you're really stuck because you're phoning the wards. The phone doesn't get answered 50% of the time. I understand. I'm not complaining. I understand nurses have a lot of other things to do. But I'm just saying, and then also people get a little bit forgetful and you might phone in the morning and then they forget. So they think nobody's phoned and so on and so on and so on. It's just, it was all over the country. It was thousands of people. And I don't think we really registered either on an individual basis or a societal basis, how traumatic that was.
Unless you ended up finding yourself in those particular circumstances, yeah. as you did.
Yeah.
And how did that change the book for you? Because I suppose there was a certain degree of detachment for you over yeah. the previous 4 years as you've been working through, and you became close to some people as you worked through, particularly with one individual in a hospice. But when it became became your own family story, I mean, How well informed were you for that then by all of what you had seen in your work in the previous years?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because in a way it helped me, you know, because I had my father died in July 2020, and the book was pretty much, you know, all the other research was pretty much done then. So I had spent several, you know, weeks with Bernie in the hospice, and I'd seen her die. I'd never seen anybody die before. That was something. So actually, I think it helped when my father was dying, you know. And also, I want to emphasize, my dad was 87, and he'd hate anybody doing, as he would say, the old camolia about him dying. I realise, you know, I speak to a couple who lost their baby, Cleva, when she was born. I speak to people who've lost young adults. So I'm not equating the deaths, but my family's experience. But I think it really did help me. I kind of knew what it looked like. I knew what was going on, because I think part of the shock and the trauma of dying is the bereaved people and the loved ones' relatives coming to terms with alien environments, you know, coming into accident emergency, going, God, what the hell is this? What are the nurses doing? That's all incredibly adds to the stress, I think. And with my father, he came from the nursing home, and like anyone coming from a nursing home, he had to go into the COVID A&E. He had to have a COVID test. But he was on his own in there. So we were very quiet. You know, the family was, it wasn't like he died in a trolley in the corridor of a hospital, which has happened to friends of mine with their, you know, well, not that their parents died, but they were on trolleys in a corridor for 36 hours before they got a bed. Now, that's really traumatic.
But
and I wouldn't say that happened to us.
Was your father conscious of being on his own, though, do you think? Did he?
How do you mean?
Well, did he want people with him, family with him?
When he was dying?
Yes.
I think he did, because, and again, I had observed this with Bernie's death. See, my sister and brother live abroad. They weren't coming home. They weren't going to be at the deathbed, and they weren't going to be at the funeral. And that was very hard. That was another enforced separation for them, that they couldn't be with the family during the mourning period, you know. My brother still hasn't been able to get home. We hope he'll get home for Christmas. Anyway, when I think he was, because it was when my brother and my mother arrived, he died within 20 minutes. And I think there's something in us that we hold on. I observed that with Bernie as well. We were all there for quite a long time, for maybe 3 hours. And when her brother had to come from outside Dublin, when he arrived, she died very soon after that. So maybe there's some kind of animal thing in us that we wait until everybody who can be there is there. I would respect that, actually. I would believe it.
Talk to me a little bit about funerals and the Irish tradition of funerals, because like in your father's case, I think you had 30 people, wasn't
35,
it?
35,
35 was the number that was allowed.
Yeah.
And there were many funerals where only 10 people were allowed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And funerals seem to be so important part of the Irish psyche. I mean, were you somebody who was a regular funeral goer before you actually got away? There are some people I know who I sort of jokingly say you're as bad as a politician, the number of funerals that you actually go to. Mm-hmm. But they regard it as being very important, not necessarily because they know the person who's died, because they know the family and they want to be there to offer support to the family. Yep. So if you don't get that, people suddenly turning up at the funeral. I mean, how distressed do you think was that for as many of those who were left behind?
Well, I think it is very nice for people to turn up at loads of funerals for the family. But I think I know for a fact, there are people who basically tour funerals. This is in peacetime. They tour them and every day. And not only old people, but actually old people. And it's great. A funeral in normal times is great. It's in the morning, so you can drive home or get home in the daylight and your energy is up. You see lots of people. You get mass if it's a Catholic mass. And who knows, you may be invited for a meal and to socialise further. And I really get that. And that may be in my future. Who knows? But I think the whole thing of the Irish funeral being upended like that, as you say, that tradition was just junked, basically. People found it very distressing. But that's partly to do with us being so confident about our funerals. Do you know?
How do you mean confident about our funerals?
Because I think in an Irish funeral, everybody knows what to do. They very rarely change. The pattern is there very strictly. People know what to do outside the church, know what to do inside the church. They know what to do at the wake. There's an interest in who is under the pattern, under the coffin. And that's very reassuring. So that when that went out the window, it was very distressing for people. Not for me or my family personally. We like my dad's funeral. But I think because people then feel, well, I can't make a contribution. I can't express my condolences or my sympathy or my respect. And also I can't see all my mates. And so I think that was very distressing. And I think how we adapted to that, it was very moving. See people standing in ditches applauding their neighbours as the coffin went past. I mean, maybe it might shift our view of the funeral way.
Of course, there are different types of funeral, aren't there?
Because there are.
It does strike me that some funerals are very, very sad occasions because somebody may have died unexpectedly by accident or by suicide or may have so young taken so young, and it's an incredible sadness. Mm. And then you get funerals where they become almost a celebration of somebody's life. Mm. But it's also struck me at times that while that's wonderful for those left behind who are mourning, I just wonder, do these people know how popular they were before they died? Wouldn't it be lovely if they'd actually seen the love for them and the respect for them before they died?
Yeah, I actually have had those thoughts myself, and I know several families, where the extended family, where the older people in the family are saying, this is before COVID, we're going to have a party because the next time you all meet up, it'll be my funeral. And I want to see you before then. So I think that's a very good. And then, of course, you go to your relative's funeral and you're standing outside and you're talking to your cousins or whatever, or old family friends, and you go, God, this is great. These people are great. And we only meet at funerals. Like, there comes a point in your life when it's not weddings anymore, it's funerals. And I do think that's a bit of a shame, actually. I do think it's a shame that people don't realise the lovely things that will be said about them at their funeral, for example. Publicly respected. I do think that's a bit of a shame.
To finish, Amory Horan, as author of Sorry for Your Trouble, The Irish Way of Death, you've decades ahead of you, hopefully. But has it made you think more about your own death and your circumstances of death and even what happens after death?
Yes, it has, actually. In fact, I was just thinking about that on my way in here. I had great teachers. Bernie was a great teacher in that Bernie was younger than me. She died when she was 58. And she didn't want to die. She didn't want to leave her children and she didn't want to leave her grandchildren. But she arranged her whole funeral. Like, she phoned up and said to the funeral director, come in and bring me, you know, the catalogue so I can choose my coffin. She phoned up Brian Whiteside and said, I want you to celebrate my funeral. The only time that's ever happened in his career. And also my dad was very brave. He was a tough guy. He was very strong. So they had made all those arrangements before they died. And it's a very compassionate thing to do for those you leave behind. And I want to now be practicing what I preach myself so that, you know, I'd update my will and arrange my funeral. Because I think those days of chaos after a death are very stressful for the family. And I was really grateful that, you know, we kind of didn't know what to do because my dad never wanted a funeral in the first place. But that's another story. And anything that you can take out of that, I think, is a very loving thing to do.
Amory Horahan, the book is Sorry for Your Trouble, The Irish Way of Death. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word.
Thank you, Matt, for having me.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today.